Hello and welcome to Citizen Kane Minute, the show that examines the greatest film of all time, 5 minutes at a time. Proud member of the Fine Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me to discuss minutes 85 to 90 of Citizen Kane is my pal and fellow network all-star, Max Romero. Hi, Max.
Hey, Rob. Happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here, Max. It's very exciting. We're going to be talking about minutes 85 to 90 of Citizen Kane. They're going to start with Thompson leaving Jed Leland, and they're going to end with Susan in the middle of performing her horrible opera. But before we get to all that, Max, I got to ask you, like I ask everybody else, when did you first see Citizen Kane?
You know, that's actually a difficult question because I'm not sure when I saw Citizen Kane for the first time. And as a child of the 70s and 80s, I definitely grew up always hearing about Orson Welles, because he was just this presence, I think. And my dad was also a big fan of War of the Worlds. So that's probably the first time I heard about Orson Welles was, his involvement in that. But Citizen Kane was a movie I probably saw in bits and pieces here and there, but it wasn't that easy to find in those days because you basically had to wait for it to show up on TV because, you know, that was pre-VHS and that sort of thing. And then even when VHS came out, I'm not sure it would have been that easy to find. I want to say that the first time I saw Citizen Kane was maybe when I was in my 20s. So when I was already in college, that was probably when I first saw it in its totality.
Virtually everybody that's been on the show saw it in college. Everybody. Mm-hmm. I'm so jealous. I didn't go to a real college at this point. Because everyone saw it in college. Do you remember what you... Yeah, okay. Let me back up a little. Yeah, Orson Welles was such a preeminent cultural figure in the 70s and 80s. He was on The Tonight Show all the time, and he did commercials, and like he was easy to parody. John Candy parodied him on SCTV. And in a lot of ways, they didn't always explain who he was. You know, they didn't say, oh, it's Citizen Kane, because they assumed you knew. So as a kid, you're kind of like, this guy must be pretty important. I don't know why, but he must be because he's everywhere. You know, he's on television. He's on the Dean Martin roast, for God's sakes. You know what I mean? He must be this guy. He's in the Muppet movie. You know, he's the guy that gives them the rich and famous contract. But you didn't really know. So as a kid, you kind of just roll with it. You're like, all right, he must be a big deal because everyone's acting like he's a big deal.
Right. It's like everyone's first reference to Humphrey Bogart being a Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Totally. You're dealing with the pop culture spillover, not the actual guy. So do you recall what you thought of it when you saw it?
I knew I was watching something special. And I say that because sometimes you hear about movies that people say, oh, you have to watch this. You have to watch that. And it's a classic. And sometimes it holds up and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you have to really think about the context of the time that the movie was made in. But Citizen Kane has elements of that, but it surpasses those elements. It rises above all that because it is essentially about not greed, and greed's not the right word, but just ego.
Yeah.
And you know, it's about a powerful man and his ego and how it affects every element of his life and every person in his life. And that is universal and timeless. And when I remember at the end of that movie feeling like, oh, I get it. I understand why people say this movie is such a big deal. And it is a movie that there aren't a lot of movies that I recommend to everybody because everyone's different and everyone has their different tastes. This is a movie that I do recommend to everybody. I think everyone should watch Citizen Kane at least once.
Obviously, I completely agree with that. But yeah, telling people they have to see it, it's just like the worst thing to do because you make it sound like homework. But again, we keep trying to say it's just really fun. It's just a really fun movie. It's a great story, well told, and you don't have to deal with all of the supposed importance of it. It's just a great story.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things too is that everyone hears about Orson Welles as a director, but his acting in this is outstanding.
Yeah, he's terrific.
Yeah, he is. I cannot imagine another actor of that era, or actually, even if like, you know, God forbid they were to do a remake of this, I can't imagine anyone else doing it. I mean, this Orson Welles' thumbprint is on this so deeply, and rightfully so. I can't picture anyone else in that role.
Yeah, I don't even know. I can't imagine someone of that that outsized personality that could even come even close to that. I mean, luckily, we don't have anybody in real life that we could base a Citizen Kane remake on, some sort of really, you know, rich guy that got into politics and never should have and just destroyed everything that he touched. I mean, luckily, that's just the remnant, relic of the 40s.
That's a fantasy now.
That's a complete fantasy, yes. Have you gone back to this movie every so often, or do you watch movies repeatedly?
You know, I hadn't seen it so I saw it in college because I don't remember if I mentioned this to you or not, but my college in the student union building had a movie theater, and they would show classic movies and sort of like cult movies. I saw a lot of things at that theater, and I hadn't seen it probably again since then in a long time. And, you know, it's just one of those things of, you know, I was working at a newspaper. My life was, you know, my schedule was topsy-turvy. There just wasn't time. There wasn't time to rewatch things. But maybe a few years ago, I caught it on TCM, more than likely. And since then, if I see it on TV, I watched it. And actually, since we talked about it and you asked me to come onto the show and talk about it a little bit, I have probably watched it three more times since then. And, you know, so we're talking like four times in the past year so that I've seen it. Part of it is just to kind of refresh myself, but also it is very rewatchable, you know, and it's one of those movies that you see more every time you watch it. It's, there is a lot going on, not only in the story, but how it's shot, what's in the background, what the actors are doing. And it is definitely a movie that you get more and more out of the more you watch it.
Oh, completely. I also think that the non-linear storytelling helps keep it fresh. Mm-hmm. So when you do drop in on it an hour in, you're like, I don't even remember where I am in this story. What happens after this part? And then you just sit and watching it. Before you know it, it's over. You're like, oh, geez, watch it all over again.
Yeah, and you know, and the way these 5 minutes begin is a good example of that, because you know we're talking to someone who knew Kane back in his early days, his earliest days actually, you know, and now he's in essentially what's an old folks home, and you know, and the movie does that throughout because that's how they're telling the story. It's just this has all already happened, and it works really well because it almost. I don't want to say because it sounds like a negative. It's almost episodic, but what it really is more almost like looking into someone's diary. You know, you're pulling out these entries, and it's just fascinating the way it works because all of this is from people around Kane, not Kane himself. And I think that conceit is just so ambitious, and Wells just pulls it off so well.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, it very much is like selections of a diary. You're getting little bits and pieces of different people's memory and stuff. And in fact, right during this section of the movie, you're going to have scenes. We're going to see the same scene twice in just a couple of minutes spread apart because it is so fractured. And that is one of the fun things about this, about the way that Wells tells the story. For the first half of this show's run, I've been asking people, do they think Citizen Kane is the greatest film of all time? I've changed the question a bit now to where, what films would you put on a list of greatest of all time? Because that helps to me. That's more instructive of what kind of baseline you would give. Would you put Kane on that list? And what other ones would you put? Not necessarily your favorites, but what do you think? Like, again, we're always talking American films too, because I just don't know enough about world cinema to even judge that. But what other movies do you think belong on a pantheon alongside sort of Citizen Kane?
Wow, that's still a tough one. I would definitely put Citizen Kane on that list, for sure. I would probably, this is going to be a sound like a strange selection because it's so different. I would actually maybe put the Ten Commandments on that.
Okay.
Just because to me, it is one of the best examples of this kind of sweeping epic kind of movie that has a lot of good acting in it and tells a story that's well known, obviously, but brings something else to it. Along those lines, Lawrence of Arabia, I would put on that list. Gosh, you know, it's Double Indemnity. I would put on that list. Just The Apartment, directed by Billy Wilder, is actually one of my favorite movies, and a movie that I don't push on people, but I always say, oh, have you ever seen The Apartment?
Great movie.
Because I love that movie. I love Billy Wilder in general. There's a handful of movies I can think of off the top of my head, but yeah, Citizen Kane would definitely be on that list.
Fair enough. I said, that's a great list of movies. I mean, you can't, I love, again, The Apartment and The Ten Commandments on the same list is fun. One's about a lecherous guy using his apartment for tryst, and the other one's about Moses. That's fantastic.
I am a many layered onion.
That's right. Yes. I contain multitudes. So, okay. So let's talk about these minutes. As I said, they're going to start. It's minute 85. It's going to start with Mr. Thompson finally wrapping up his interview with Jed Leland, and it's going to end with Susan performing at the opera. After Jed insults the nurses, he talks about how ugly they are. he gets carted off, and I haven't been talking much so far about the Bernard Herrmann score, which of course is masterful. Mm-hmm. But I love the kind of minor music key that he puts on it, where it's like the sad thing of, like, you get the sense that this is probably the last time anyone's going to visit Jed Leland.
Right.
And you know, it's kind of a sad thing. He's this old man, and he's clearly still got his wherewithal. You know, he's able to tell stories and make jokes and be sarcastic, and he's not really, and the way he gets up out of the chair, he seems to be walking fine. So you're almost like, well, why is he in an old folks home? Other than it's just, he doesn't have any family and there's no one to take care of him, but he seems like he's doing pretty well. And so I love the Herrmann music there of just kind of, you get the sense that Mr. Thompson visiting him might be the last person that anybody is going to bother to visit Jed Leland, which is a darn shame.
And he even mentions that. I think it's his last line in his scene where he's, because he's been trying to sneak cigars.
Yeah, wrap them up so they don't know him at the desk.
Right. And he says that his doctor has this funny idea about keeping him alive.
Yep.
And so I don't know exactly what that's implying. I kind of get the sense that he is ill, you know, possibly from lung cancer. I don't know, but I get that sense that he is almost in a hospice situation, because like you said, you know, he still seems to move around pretty well. He's still sharp. Obviously he can remember all these details about Kane. But he's there for some reason. And the music goes along very well with that, because his whole attitude is very, it's very light himself. You know, he's talking about these things like, oh, can you believe these crazy things I remember, or that we went through? And he almost has that, he has that distance that age and possibly approaching death can give you of how small those things can suddenly seem.
Yeah, he's definitely still got that glint in his eye. And that might be partly because Joseph Cotten, of course, was a young man when he shot this. Even with the old age makeup. But yeah, he seems like a perfectly reasonable, coherent person. And yeah, you're right. They probably are saying that he is sick. He's got something wrong with him. And then the doctors are trying to prolong his life, and he's almost like, why are you bothering? Let me just give me my cigars and let me just enjoy my life. You know, I mean, what the hell at this point? I also like that for some reason, Jed Leland kind of has an accent now, which he doesn't really have, because he's like, wrap those cigars in a box. And you're like, why is he talking like that? He's not from like wherever that accent is from, but it doesn't matter. Right. It's like, it's just kind of old people start to talk. When you start characterizing old people, that's how they talk.
Yeah, it is a strange choice, because he does not speak like that.
No,
earlier in the movie.
Yeah, there's an old Richard Belzer bit where he said that he's Jewish, and he said every person he knows in his family, once they get to a certain, they start talking like this. I go to the store and I go, and he's like, we don't talk like that. But you just become that way. He's like, it's just the way it happens. So after Jed, we leave Jed. We go back to the El Rancho bar and restaurant where we're going to see Susan Alexander again. And it's fun that the shot that we get, the camera sweeping through the sign and into the skylight, it's the same exact shot that we saw from the previous, earlier in the film, where we see Susan Alexander for the first time. It is the exact same shot, just reused footage. And I don't want to, you know, it's always dangerous to kind of say, oh, when the film is made by a genius filmmaker, when there's a mistake, it's because it was intentional. But when a bad filmmaker makes a mistake, it's because they're a hack. Well, no, sometimes the good filmmaker can make a mistake. So I don't want to give Wells like too much credit, although the show is called Citizen Kane Minute. But there's something, because this movie, especially these midsection, is all about memory and all about overlapping reminiscences and different people's opinion. There's something almost perfect thematically about reusing the same exact footage for yet another visit with Susan Alexander. It's almost this kind of like, yeah, we're kind of just lost in the haze of memory now. We don't even know who's this memory is anymore. And it's fine that the shot is being used. Odds are it was just reused because it just was cost effective to reuse it. But to me, it almost works in that you're like, okay, are we winding back to the beginning of the movie now? I don't even really know anymore. I kind of like that.
You know, a question occurs to me, you mentioning that. Do you think there are any reliable narrators in Citizen Kane?
I think some of them, yes. I think we're all getting it filtered through their perspective to a certain extent. Now, does that mean that they're lying? Not necessarily, but they're all, you know, we're getting Jed's view of it. We're getting Bernstein's view of it. We're getting Susan's view of it. They're all filtering it through their own. I mean, even Bernstein's recollections are not too bad in terms of making Kane look great because he knows he loved Kane. So, I think ultimately they're all relatively reliable, but it's all filtered through their own personal experience, which is, of course, how else are you going to do it?
Right. Yeah. It's something that occurred to me, you know, just as we were, as we're talking about that, because as you said, it's all filtered through people. And even, I think even when people are trying to tell the truth, it's hard to get past that filter, you know, and again, you know, we never get Kane's point of view on any of this except right. through what other people tell us about him.
Right. And when we get to Susan, I mean, we see at least initially she seems to be, when we saw her at the beginning of the movie and she's drunk and she tells Thompson to basically leave her alone. And now he's come back to see her a second time and she's obviously a lot more amenable and she seems even to kind of have some humor about it. And then she does say, you know, I didn't even want to be a singer. I didn't want to do any of this, but Charlie made me do it. And she seems a little more rueful about it. She starts to smile as if she's remembering some of the nicer elements from that, even though she's about to relay some pretty rough stuff in her life. But I kind of like that, at least in this moment, she's maybe remembering some things that weren't all bad. And so maybe she's coming at a little more fair, a little more fairly. Than she did in the initial segment, because then she was really drunk and really angry. But yeah, I kind of like that, you know, she's like remembering some of the good days, some of the good things that happened here. And it has another glorious fade in where the light behind Susan fades out into complete blackness as the light from her apartment fades up as we see her training, doing her opera training. You know, I love all these transitions that Wells does. They're just great.
And I was going to mention that also as we're kind of coming in on the sign, on the El Rancho sign. I kind of love that the sign is not lit.
Yeah.
you know, and it's just, you know, there's this feeling of in the scene, there is a feeling of brokenness and loneliness, and you know, and I think the unlit sign is kind of a preview of what we're going to see with Susan as she's sitting in this darkened bar. You know, this is supposed to be a place of, you know, laughter and music and loud, you know, people speaking loudly to each other, and she is there alone in this cavernous space that is going to be reflected in what used to be her home.
You do got to wonder why she's there, because clearly there's no business. Like, the place is not open.
Right.
Maybe they will be open soon, but it's like, why is she there just sitting there drinking when
right.
you should I probably
think she just
be
has
somewhere
nowhere else to go.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. We see her in Charlie's apartment, presumably, because it's not her apartment anymore, and she's getting the opera training. Now, I mentioned in the previous episode the actor who plays the opera coach. This is Fortunio Bonanova. The one credit I wanted to mention, again, I went into his credits previously in another episode, but I wanted to mention his one credit that particular interest to you, Max. He was one of the soldiers in Mark of Zorro.
Is he really?
Yeah. He's near the end of that movie where we covered that on Film and Water a couple of months ago. He's uncredited in Mark of Zorro. He wasn't as much of a name, but by this time he gets a fairly decent sized part as the opera coach. But yes, he was in Mark of Zorro.
It all comes back to Zorro.
And I love when he's going to da 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 da, and then she tries and she's just terrible, and then he's finally so frustrated he's like impossible. And he's so frustrated. And I have such oh my God, the sympathy I have for poor Susan, because it's clear Charlie has not really given her any chance to not do this. And she's trying so hard. And there's something so relatable and pathetic about you're trying to do this thing and you just know you're bad at it and there's nothing you can do. And then there's a part where she kind of like breaks a note and the opera coach gets mad and he starts gesturing down at the piano player. And Dorothy Cummingore lowers her face and she just looks so just crushed because she knows how bad she is. And if, I mean, on the one hand, I understand the opera coach is really frustrated because he's like, she's so terrible. At the same time, how are you ever going to learn when that's your teacher, when they're right. just completely berating right. you like that?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and this, it all kind of reflects Kane's power, because obviously, you know, this is not some opera teacher off the street. This is probably one of the top opera, you know, teachers or coaches, and used to working with real divas. And yeah, you know, as even Susan is ready to admit that's not her.
Yep.
And she knows it, but Kane's influence and his will being forced upon others is so strong that she can't even deny, you know, even she can't just turn around and say, you know, Charlie, this isn't what I want to do, or I'm no good at it. I kind of get the sense like she probably enjoys singing, but understands her limitations.
Yeah.
And she is being quite literally, you know, forced into this past the point where it's even anything that she wants.
Yeah, she's miserable. She's not enjoying herself at all. After Charlie walks in and argues with the opera coach, and he basically says something like, you know, she's impossible, I can't train her. And he's like, I'm not hiring you to give me your opinions. You're just supposed to get her ready. And so she tries again, and then she clearly doesn't do it well. And the opera coach's face, well, he's kind of, and then again, she has that misery. She looks like she's ready to cry.
Yeah.
And it's really heartbreaking. And I will say, I didn't really notice it first, however many times I've seen Citizen Kane, because I was kind of looking at Kane. But when you look at her, it's like she's just so sad that she knows she's not good at this. And Kane, who's presumably loves her, just will not let it go. I mean, right. He is just and he's all about himself at this point. And she's got to sit there and be terrible in front of people. And then she continues on. And then Kane has that thing. He's like, see, you know, we knew we could do it my way. And he looks so happy. And you're like, dude, what do you think we're accomplishing here?
Yeah, it's the satisfaction of getting his way. And that's all he wants. And Dorothy Cummingore as Susan Alexander Kane is just doing a wonderful job of acting in this very subtle but powerful way. You know, as you mentioned, you know, it's hard not to look at Orson Welles when he enters the room. He just has that charisma that you're just instantly drawn to him. But Cummingore is, you know, she is acting on a level that ties that whole scene together. Because as you said, you know, she is obviously miserable, but she's not crying. She's not shouting. She's not falling apart. But she looks like she has the weight of the world on her shoulders, and she looks trapped, which I think she is. And she does all that just through this sad, sad look on her face. And it's just such an impressive piece of acting.
Yeah. When you're doing something and you know that you're going to hate it or you're just not good at it, that really does break your heart, because you're just all the effort it takes to do this thing, and then you know it's just not going to work out well. It's just like, you know, I mean, it's so sad. So yeah, she is really terrific in the scene. And then we do another transition via music of where she's singing, and then we cut to her actually singing, you know, getting ready to sing in the opera. And she's in her kind of like, she's got like this headpiece on, and she almost looks like she's going to cry. Mm-hmm. And right as she's sort of singing this note, the opera coach comes back in and he goes, no, 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 no. And he's shaking his fists at her.
Yeah.
He comes a little bit like he's Super Mario Brothers or something. But he's screaming at her. And again, it's like, I understand that he probably realizes he's about to be embarrassed because he's got his name attached to this person who's terrible. But man, talk about, there's, you know, undermining her confidence. Mm-hmm. Literally, as they're putting her costume on, they put this big headdress on with a big feather on it. And she's about to go out on stage. Meanwhile, he's screaming at her.
Right.
And it's like, well, that, you know, she's not going to get any better by doing that to her, because she's, you know, you're flipping her out.
Mm-hmm. No. And, you know, again, like you said, you know, she just looks terrible. She just looks, not physically terrible, but she looks so sad. And it's because she knows, you know, I mean, like you're saying about Matisse, the opera coach, is, you know, he's worried about his reputation and all that. But Susan knows that she is about to be humiliated, and there is nothing she can do about it.
Oh,
and she's going to do her best, but she knows that her best is not good enough, and that her husband is basically forcing her into this humiliating experience in front of a crowd of people. And it's devastating.
Yeah. I mean, just the idea of trying to perform opera when you know you can't sing, you're like, oh my God, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's all these rapid cuts to the chaos of the opera. And again, I love, you know, Wells's ability to pull one over on us. I mean, this whole movie is him pulling one over on us, but we see backstage of this opera, and because of the way it's lit, we have so many of the actors in silhouette, and they're running back and forth, and it gives the impression that this production has got hundreds of people, and there's probably only about 20 actors, really.
Right.
But because they're in silhouette and they're in costumes that are sort of hard to discern, I'm sure Wells has just got them running back and forth. You know, you go from left to right, you go from right to left, you go behind, and it makes the production look huge when, again, probably they were not spending a lot of money on this, but it's a great trick. And that it just seems like, oh my God, this is the amount of money Kane must be spending in this production has got to be a fortune. And you're like, well, right. We really don't see that many people, really.
Right. Right. And it is interesting because I think this is where they also mentioned, you know, that Kane is going to build an opera house for her.
Yep.
And also, you know, going back to the Hearst reference, he talks about how he owns all these newspapers and he knows that they're going to have good reviews.
Yeah. I run several newspapers.
Right. Right. And you know, just the hinted at and the unspoken power of Kane, I think really comes through in these, I mean, it's throughout the movie, obviously. But it really comes out in these scenes, just because through sheer force of will, he is trying to create something that everyone knows does not exist.
Yeah.
You know, and it's because it's something that he's done before. It's something that, you know, it's something that he's done before. It's something he'll do again. And, you know, at this point, you know, Kane is already a master of his universe. You know, he already knows that he can basically do and get whatever he wants. And the cost, whether it's financial or personal or whatever, does not matter to him. What matters is that he gets what he wants.
Yeah, pretty much. And again, and like the scale of this opera that she's doing, we see the curtain come up, and again, like through the, we see the footlights and the lights out in the back, out in the balconies and stuff. Again, we don't see a single person. But we get the sense this is a huge theater. Mm-hmm. She's performing. And it's like, she is a terrible singer. She's never done this before. And for whatever reason, she's been put into an opera where she is the first voice by herself coming out on stage. Like, you couldn't even come up with an opera to put her in where maybe she's one of the singers or a singer that comes in later in the production. It's like, no, we're going to make her the whole thing.
Yeah.
And that way it's completely inescapable that she's terrible.
Right. And I love this scene because I don't know if you've ever been on a stage or not. I've never acted, but I've worked around stages. And, you know, that's pretty common when you're on a stage, you have the floodlights and all that. You can't really see very far into the audience, but, I love it because, you know, as I said, she is so profoundly alone in this moment. Yep. And as the curtains open and you just see this black space beyond the footlights, that really just emphasizes how, you know, and as you said, you know, she's the first voice. It looks like it's going to be a solo piece. Oh, so she is out there by herself, staring into this silent blackness. And it is just, you know, it makes her look, you know, and she's in this elegant costume and she looks so small. You know, she looks like a lamb to slaughter because she is out there on that stage by herself, and it's not where she wants to be. And that scene just encompasses that so well. I love that when the curtains open, that is, it gives me goosebumps to see that.
Yeah. Oh, it's just this poor woman. And mm-hmm. and then as she's singing, we cut to Kane and he's almost in tears.
Yeah.
He's so happy. And I've been saying this across different episodes. Like, does he not know that she's bad? Is he fooling himself? I mean, is it just he's in love with the idea that he made this happen and he's not even really paying attention to the pain that he's inflicting on his wife. It's really now just, I made this happen, and he's almost crying over his own, you know, large, you know, his own hugeosity. You know, right. Look what I did. I built an opera house just so this woman can sing and all these people are here, both on the stage and in the audience, all because of me. Is he crying over his own greatness?
Right. Yeah. I think that's definitely a part of it. I think it's like, look at what I have done. But I think it's also, I think at this point, his ego has gotten so large that he automatically just thinks that whatever his opinion is must be the correct opinion.
Mm.
So if he thinks that his wife is a great opera singer, then it must mean that she's a great opera singer, and everyone else is just too stupid to see it. And I think it's this weird sense that he has convinced himself as much as he's convinced anyone else.
Probably, yeah. Like I said, I love the ever slight tear that he's got. He's just so he's just so happy. And then the 5 minutes are going to end right as we see how huge his production is. We see all these people in the background and costume. Again, this is just a massive, massive effort, all in the effort of really all the service of nothing, really, because it's all going to collapse. So it's, it's not going to collapse in that he's going to make her keep going against her will, but everyone knows instantly how terrible it is. And again, we've all done things or been involved in things where we know this is just going to be terrible. And I have to get through it. And it's heartbreaking. And so, yeah, Dorothy Cumming Orr, unfortunately, really did not have much of a career, much of an acting career after this. There are some other external reasons for that. But it's a shame because she's, like everyone, she's terrific in this movie. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge part for her. And it's she deserved better from Hollywood. I mean, that's true of a lot of people, but she's terrific in this movie. And you know, this scene in particular, just as much as she becomes angry and difficult later on, just the way her lower lip quivers just breaks my heart.
Yeah. I think it's something, and I think we've mentioned it before on your Film and Water podcast, but I'm going to sound like an old man. I'm not nearly this old, but I think back in those days, even character actors and bit actors, doing secondary characters, brought a lot more craft to their acting than you might see nowadays. Even past that, you know, and Dorothy Cumming Orr, I think, is an example of that. And she is, you know, I agree. I'm surprised that she did not have a bigger career than she did.
I mean, part of it, again, is that she gets to play kind of a harsh character. Other than the initial scenes, it's not the most flattering character in the world, but nevertheless, she's terrific. And what a presentation to be in this movie. And she's basically, all of her scenes are with Orson Welles, and she's holding her own.
Yeah.
With Orson Welles, which is pretty darn impressive. So yeah, right. it's a sad couple of minutes, unfortunately, right. And it's only going to kind of get worse for everybody involved. But that's the story of Citizen Kane.
I love how in the scene previous to this one, where Matisse is coaching Susan at the house. I love that Kane walks into the room and kind of stands in the back. And they don't notice him at first. and he's just there. But I think that's a really nice way of putting a pin in how big a presence Kane is in everyone's lives. Even when they don't see him, he is there.
Yeah, he's there. You know? Yeah.
And like I mentioned earlier, you know, he walks in, you know, Orson Welles walks into a room and you can't help but look at him. And this is especially true in this scene, because he walks in and he just stands there.
Yep.
That's all he does. But it's almost chilling the way he stands there, because he is watching something that he has put into motion. And it's just, and you don't know what's going to happen. And Matisse, as you mentioned, you know, he gets very loud, he gets very florid, and he's, you know, no, and, you know, that to Susan, all this stuff. And it's interesting because as loud as Matisse is, Kane is quiet, you know, because he has that power. He doesn't need to raise his voice. He just has to say something, and Matisse backs off instantly. And, you know, this movie, there's just so many elements going on in every scene. It's, you know, and just these little touches that are just, they have so much finesse, but so much power behind them.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. You know, even though you know that Susan and the Matisse are not having any fun during this training, mm-hmm. you know that it's even going to get less fun now that Charlie has showed up and he's going to boss them around. But yeah. I said it, I never really thought, I mean, I saw it obviously, but I never really considered it that, the way he walks in and then just stands there for like a full couple of beats,
mm-hmm.
and just surmises the situation. And then he's like, all right, this guy seems like he's ready to quit. No, you're not quitting. Nobody's right. quitting. You're not quitting, Susan. You're not quitting. You're going to keep the poor piano player who never gets a line. He's just standing there. He's just sitting there like, okay, I'm just going to try to blend into the background over here. Again, we've all been through that. So yeah, it's a sad couple of minutes. And unfortunately, it's only getting worse. But that's the tragedy of Citizen Kane. So, mm-hmm. Max, thank you so much for coming by and talking Citizen Kane with me. You know, I enjoy recording with you. And, just recently we, talked Human Fly. Right. So I like the idea that, you know, we are Renaissance men. We can talk about the Human Fly, or we can talk about Citizen Kane. It's or over in Film and Water, we'll talk about disreputable, genre movies. You know, we have lots of interest.
I love it all. I love it all. There's room in our hearts for all of this.
That is true. So why don't you tell people where they can find you here on the network?
As you mentioned, they can find me right here on the network. I do, as you mentioned, the Human Flycast. I also do a Plastic Man podcast called It's the Plasticast. And I do a literary podcast called The Mirror Factory. And you can find me here on our website. And you can also find me under various handles on Twitter and Facebook.
Excellent. All great shows, and I really enjoy them all. So so that's going to do it for this episode. Of course, you can find back episodes of our show on the website, as Max just mentioned, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any of the podcatchers of your choice. We're always talking Citizen Kane over on Twitter at CKaneMinute. And then finally, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast. And there you're going to unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Slick. I really appreciate his/her support of Citizen Kane Minute. So that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Come back next week for more Citizen Kane Minute.
What's the real truth about Charles Foster Kane? I wish you'd come to this theater when Citizen Kane plays here and decide for yourself.